Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of
GF Investment Services, LLC
are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Any investments based on Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Hello, everyone. It's nice to be with you again on this Monday, the 13th of April, 2015. All the way from Southeast Asia, I am your host, Richard Martin, with the Wake Up Call. Well, as I've mentioned many times before, mainstream establishment economic statistical numbers are, for the most part, utter garbage. They are not legitimate. They are meaningless. The figures and statistics that do have some truth to them are so obscured from the public view and unreported by the media that they may as well be state secrets. The average person has no clue of their existence because his primary sources of information are establishment-dominated. Even mainstream media talking heads and economic analysts are so mesmerized by the false version of the economic world that they have no point of reference when suddenly confronted with singular facts. Some people call this catastrophic behavior a positive feedback loop. It is a mainstream echo chamber that has become a financial tomb. I've recently covered the lies within the economy that I've been able to prove to you here on the Wake Up Call, absolutely and, I hope, convincingly. It's now time to move on to a discussion of the lies that are more difficult to pin down. These lies often slip past the realm of investigation, because the hard data that could be used to expose them is simply not available to the general public. In fact, much of the data isn't even available to government officials. I am, of course, talking about the hard data behind the activities of central banks across the globe, the International Monetary Fund, the Bank for International Settlements, and the Federal Reserve in particular. I'm going to examine the purpose of these lies. Primary among these is the desire to hide the imminent destruction of the American currency with fiat dollars by doing whatever it takes. I mentioned recently here how real U.S. liabilities have been revealed to exceed by far the official statistics announced by the Treasury Department. We're talking about $200 trillion currently owed, not owed in some distant future where none of us will be alive to worry about it. The debt issue most responsible for this problem has been created through entitlement programs, as well as a Social Security program that the government uses as its own constant cycling taxpayer-supported personal slush fund, triggering a debt accumulation of more than $8 trillion a year. Many people are curious about how the American government, or any government with a central bank, continues to function monetarily if it is generating far more debt than it will ever be able to pay off in tax revenues. Well, the reality is that the system doesn't really function. It just refuses to die. This happens through the process of fiat money creation. The quantitative easing programs allowed the Federal Reserve to conjure massive stores of fiat money out of thin air and purchase U.S. Treasury bonds, among other things. They were a blatant and open admission by bureaucrats and central bankers alike that the government has not been capable of sustaining its own operations without fiat aid. Let me repeat, quantitative easing programs are in and of themselves hard evidence of government insolvency. Solvent governments do not need to monetize their own debt obligations with a printing press. The limited TARP audit of 6+ years ago revealed a money creation scheme in excess of $16 trillion. And by the way, what are called overnight swaps are still a devaluing action, though some idiot mainstream pundits argue they are not debt creation. Anyway, since there has been little information available to the public in regards to the true level of paper and digital money conjured up from the ethers, we have no idea to what extent the dollar has ultimately been devalued, and we won't know until foreign investors and banks finalize their decoupling from the U.S., which will likely accelerate this year. People do argue, though, that since the financialization of the taper and the end of QE3 and the bailout programs overall, the system must be amply flush with cash yet again. And so the argument goes, the printing bonanza must have been worth the risk. Why else would the taper have been instituted at all? Well, I maintain, and I've always maintained from the very beginning, that the taper was instituted not in preparation for economic recovery, but in preparation for economic collapse. The quantitative easing bailouts have stopped because they no longer serve any purpose in propping up the false economy. For instance, the Inspector General for the Federal Housing Finance Agency is now suggesting yet another bailout for socialist New Deal failures Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, after the Obama administration reserved the right to take all profits from the conservatorship beginning in 2012. That's right. All that money that Fannie and Freddie supposedly made and paid back didn't make one ounce of difference, as the federal government now steals the profits in order to pay off other debts. In the meantime, companies like Blackstone reap the benefits as they purchase and bid on hundreds of thousands of homes for pennies on the dollar, turn them into rentals, and artificially support the illusion of a housing recovery in the United States. You might want to note that Blackstone has conveniently served as an advisor to the U.S. Treasury throughout the Fannie and Freddie bailouts. As I've said before, stimulus measures have absolutely failed to inspire any semblance of recovery in consumer demand, and global demand for goods is now imploding. Real employment has not improved at all throughout the duration of the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP, quantitative easing, or QE, and zero interest rate policy, or ZIRP. In fact, it only seems to have stalled unemployment at about 23%. Those famous stimulus actions have only served to create even more unmitigated debt while producing no tangible results other than a massive bubble in stock markets. Poverty is at record levels. Welfare demand is at record levels. Average wages are falling. Prices on essential goods except oil are rising. Global demand is visibly sliding into the same territory as in 2008-2009. Housing markets have become a corporately boosted feudalistic farce. And unemployment continues at a depressing level. Meanwhile, People aren't even counted as unemployed anymore because they've been jobless for so long. At this point, at the onset of spring 2015, I think it's safe to say that alternative economic analysts have been right all along in my assertions that central bank stimulus measures are completely useless. Though some of the slimier day traders like to argue that they tripled their profits during the stimulus period and my doom and gloom means nothing to them, in their naivete, they'll be missing the big picture. You don't play the collapse. In the end, it will play you. The Federal Reserve has failed in every aspect of its bailout quest. The consequence of this debacle is the displacement of U.S. economic standing. The U.S. is being made economically irrelevant. China has surpassed the U.S. as the world's largest exporter or importer and has long been far superior to the U.S. in manufacturing capability, making China the most valuable economic partner in the world. According to the IMF, China is now superior to the U.S. in trade standing and is soon to be the largest economy on the planet. China has recently launched its regional Asian Development Bank, a kind of Asian World Bank, and nearly 50 countries have signed on, including European allies to the U.S. The talk is growing within the mainstream circles that China is about to decouple from the U.S. economy and, along with the BRICS nations, structure a new Asia-centric financial system that will stick it to the Western financial elites. This, however, is too simplistic a notion. We're talking about the real economy, and in the real economy, no nation with a central bank actually breaks from the new world order. In fact, all conflicts between the East and West are only serving to further the cause of globalists and Fabian socialists. China alone doesn't have the capacity to replace the U.S. as a primary driver for the global economy, nor does the yuan have the capacity to replace the dollar as a world reserve currency. But this is not China's goal. It's never been China's goal. China's only purpose in its historic fiscal expansion has been to achieve inclusion in what the IMF calls the global economic reset. Part of this reset is the introduction of the IMF Global Currency Basket System, or Special Drawing Rights, SDRs, as a kind of centralized control mechanism for all currencies worldwide. The IMF and China have continuously called for the SDR basket system to replace the US dollar as the world reserve currency. Despite the hopes of some alternative writers that China will somehow break the chains of the central banking monopoly, every Chinese action since at least 2008 has been in preparation to become a full slave nation under the control of IMF policy. China has now officially submitted its currency, the yuan, for inclusion as a reserve currency in the SDR basket. China's central bank has openly called for the IMF to take a dominant role in the management of the world's currencies through the SDR basket system. The world economic crisis shows what Governor Zhu Jiangquan calls, quote-unquote, the inherent vulnerabilities and systemic risks in the existing international monetary system. He was writing in an essay released last Monday by the bank. He recommended creating a currency made up of a basket of global currencies and controlled by the International Monetary Fund, and said it would, quote-unquote, help to achieve the objective of safeguarding global economic and financial stability. The IMF conference on the SDR, which takes place every 5 years, is set to begin preliminaries in May and finish in October or November. It is widely expected that China's currency will indeed be included in the SDR this year, that this will adversely affect the dollar's standing as the world's reserve currency, and that the U.S. will have little capacity to stop such a development. That's because American veto power within the IMF is likely to be removed due to a lack of approval on funding measures and policy changes put to Congress in 2010. I have often warned that the destruction of the U.S. position within the IMF would be blamed on political gridlock over the refusal by Congress to confirm policy changes from 2010, and the brunt of the blame would be placed on conservatives. Last week, my suspicions were supported by the statement of Larry Summers, a former Treasury Secretary and elitist, who was partially responsible for the end of Glass-Steagall and the creation of the derivatives bubble, and the man who claimed history will overwhelmingly approve QE. Summers decried the end of the U.S. as the underwriter of the global economic system, also stating, and I quote, "largely because of resistance from the right, the U.S. stands alone in the world in failing to approve the International Monetary Fund governance reforms that Washington itself pushed for in 2009. By supplementing IMF resources, this change would have bolstered confidence in the global economy. More important, it would come closer to giving countries such as China and India a share of IMF votes commensurate with their new economic heft. With China's economic size rivaling America's and emerging markets accounting for at least half of world output, the global economic architecture needs substantial adjustment. Political pressures from all sides in the U.S. have rendered it increasingly dysfunctional." End of quote. Added enthusiasm for China's new regional bank has put the U.S. on the defensive, as supposed allies are joining the chorus calling for China to join the SDR. This would make the yuan the first currency not fully convertible to join the SDR basket. The effect of this is that it's difficult to invest directly in yuan compared to investing in dollars. But this is exactly what the IMF wants. The Asian Times, which I receive here every day, put it rather bluntly and honestly, but I quote, "Currently, central banks can't include yuan holdings in their foreign exchange reserves. However, via inclusion in the SDR basket, the currency will effectively enjoy a back door where convertibility is concerned." The upshot, according to Citibank, means increased yuan demand from central banks and further integration of the currency into global capital market flows. Importantly, China has espoused an internationalization of reserve currencies away from U.S. dollar hegemony and dependencies on local economic fluctuations on exchange rates and stability. The yuan inclusion in the basket would be a step towards a more multilateral currency world. While full convertibility may still be far away, China's ability to have a global reserve currency may soon be upon us. End of quote. Yes, that's right. China's inclusion in the SDR will help the process of marginalization of the dollar and aid in the ascendance of the SDR as a world reserve mechanism. And as China becomes a currency powerhouse in its role as the number one economy in the world, the only way central banks worldwide can benefit or invest in the yuan will be by stockpiling SDRs. Demand for SDRs will be cleverly boosted by natural demand for the yuan. This is how a global currency structure begins. The only true beneficiaries of this cycle will be the IMF and those elites who desperately want a totally centralized global economic system. In the meantime, as the dollar loses its world reserve status, it loses the only pillar of support, keeping its value somewhat stable. In the end, as the dollar falls, U.S. citizens will be reduced to second or third world economic expectations. Employment and wages will continue to dissolve, while the margins between the haves and have-nots will continue to grow. In the worst-case scenario, total chaos would result, followed by an international intervention to save us from ourselves. America's currency would likely be permanently pegged to the SDR basket, just as Argentina's was pegged to the US dollar after its collapse. And the IMF would own the US rather than the US owning the IMF, as is the common delusion. As I said, Federal Reserve stimulus actions seem to have failed miserably. Now the nation is facing a firestorm. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, don't think that that means that the dollar is going to fall right away. I think we still have some time left. I'm always a little premature in my judgments and prognostications. So don't worry, all should be well, and just wait for further developments and hold the dollar in the meantime. Right, well, let me give you my information. My name, again, is Richard Martin, and the email address that you should write to if you wish to add your questions or put your comments in or give me grief or not, as the case may be, please feel free. Write to rm@gfawd.com. Again, that's RM for Richard Martin at GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design .com. And if you'd like to call me personally, please feel free to do so. The number in Sarasota, Florida to call is area code 941-441-1682. Again, that's 941-441-1682. Well, of all the failures of recent Congresses and presidents, none is more important than their failure to deal with the nation's long-term debt. Although Congress tied itself in knots trying to address the problem, the growth of debt remains, in the words of the Congressional Budget Office, unsustainable. Debt figures tell part of the story. When the Great Recession hit, the federal debt was equal to about 40% of GDP. But to fight the recession, Congress enacted an $800 billion stimulus bill. Stimulus spending, combined with already enacted spending and tax policy, resulted in 4 years of trillion-dollar deficits. As a result, the debt ballooned to 78% of GDP in 2013, almost twice the pre-recession level. The annual deficit is now declining at a stately pace, but by 2016 it will begin increasing again, and by 2020, under CBO's alternative fiscal scenario, America will once again return to annual deficits above $1 trillion, thereby once again creating increasing the national debt. greatly so. The accumulation of debt should prevent federal policymakers from feeling any sense of accomplishment. In fact, CBO estimates that the debt will be well over 100% of GDP by 2039 under conservative assumptions about spending and revenue. When CBO incorporates its estimates of the impact of the continuing large federal deficits on the nation's economy, it estimates that the accumulated debt held by the public will reach an astounding 180% of GDP by 2039. One wonders if members of Congress or the President read these CBO reports. What's the word for America's fiscal situation? Stunning? Shocking? Desperate? In recent testimony before the Senate Budget Committee, Boston University economics professor Lawrence Kotlikoff, in effect, told the committee that all of these terms are pathetically inadequate to describe America's true fiscal situation. In compelling testimony, Kotlikoff argues that the federal fiscal situation is much worse than the CBO estimates let on. The reason is that CBO's debts estimates do not take into account the full financial obligations the government is committed to honor, especially for future payments of Social Security, Medicare, and interest on the debt. He asserts that the federal government should help the public understand the nation's true fiscal situation by using what economists call the infinite horizon fiscal gap, defined as the value of all projected future expenditures minus the value of all projected future receipts using a reasonable discount rate. What difference does the fiscal gap approach make in any understanding of the true federal debt? CBO tells us that the national debt was a little less than $13 trillion in 2014. But the fiscal gap in that year, as calculated by Kotlikoff, was $210 trillion, more than 16 times larger than the debt estimated by CBO and already judged by CBO and many others to be unsustainable. If a $13 billion gap is unsustainable, what terms should we apply to a $210 trillion gap? Kotlikoff also calculates that the fiscal gap is equal to about 58% of the combined value of all future revenue. Thus, America would need to reduce spending or increase taxes by enough to fill that 58% gap if it wanted to put the federal budget on a path to solvency that balances the interests of those now receiving benefits and those who hope to receive benefits in the future. Kotlikoff goes on to illustrate that the fiscal gap is increasing at an alarming rate and that delay makes the problem much worse. In 2003, just a little more than a decade ago, the fiscal gap was $60 trillion. But by last year, it had catapulted to $210 trillion. The fiscal gap may not continue increasing as rapidly as it has over the past decade, but with each passing year, as Congress and the President do their best to avoid action, the hole grows deeper by substantial amounts. Under the CBO estimates used by Congress, there is a huge debt hole. Under the more comprehensive fiscal gap measurement, there is a chasm, but little, if any, congressional action is planned to deal with the notorious level of debt. The country, quite simply, is headed towards a fiscal black hole. Well, I occasionally watch the Kaiser report on Russia Today, according to Eliko Haylet in an email that I am reading to you. And it seems like every week he's promoting a new cryptocurrency. I hadn't heard you mention cryptocurrency since your commentary on it sometime last year. Where does cryptocurrency stand after the Mt. Gox scandal? Can these forms of currency make any traction after the fall the current monetary system is about to endure? Thanks, Richard. Keep up the great work. Sincerely, Elio Haylet. Elio, I used to think it could, but unfortunately, very unfortunately, it seems to me that the currency crisis which is building up is far greater than anything that I had anticipated. And what they call the race to the bottom, with every country trying to make its currency even more invaluable or valueless, if you like, to the world, I don't think that cryptocurrencies will find their footing. Because I think that people would be so desperate to find their own currency in the scheme of things and to try to avoid holding it in the expectation that governments want it to fall, that I think cryptocurrencies will take a back seat for quite a while to come, if not permanently. I used to think that Bitcoin had a purpose and a place in the world. After what's happened recently with currency devaluation and degradation, I don't think that this is any more the case. So it's a good question to ask at this point in time, Elito, but I don't think it has an answer which is going to be favorable, perhaps, to what you yourself had hoped. Okay, well, Tammy Brown in Antioch, California, wrote in saying, "Dear Richard, I got a predatory loan, picker payment, in 2005 from World Savings, which was then taken over by Wachovia and then by Wells Fargo. I had put $150,000 down on a $320,000 home, borrowed $170,000. In 2006, Wells Fargo said I qualified for a loan modification. I was told that after making it through the trial period, the first 3 monthly payments of the new loan, my loan would change from the picker payment loan to a 40-year fixed, or so I thought. My escrow was included in my payment. The payment always seemed to change or to get larger, but I thought it was due to property tax going up and down or increases in homeowners insurance. 9 years later, I realized that Wells Fargo led me to believe that my loan was fixed and never informed me that any late payment in the future would cause me to lose the modified loan that I was told I had been qualified for and be permanent. I recently found out that I have an ARM loan. In the 10 years that I have owned my house, my principal balance has increased rather than decreased. I still want to get modified to a fixed loan, but don't trust these crooks. I'm so sick of these predatory too-big-to-fail banks. I've been late on payments recently due to medical bills, and they try to make it impossible for me to catch up by applying my payments to late fees before applying the money to my late payments, purposely trying to cause me to sink in a hole that they hope I can never climb out of. I would like to get out from under this predatory bank before rising interest rates cause me to lose my home to them. I've heard that they make more money if they foreclose rather than modify a loan. Right now, I luckily am employed full-time, and my payments are current. Because of this latest housing bubble, I'm told my house is listed on Zillow as being worth $20,000 more than I paid for it, or $340,000. Even if I could never get that amount, at least I owe less than it's worth. That's a plus. What would be the best way to get me out from under this predatory lender and predatory loan? I'm 53 years old and really don't need a 40-year ARM loan. Should I try to sell my four-bedroom home, pay Wells Fargo off, and buy a smaller home through another lender? Can you think of any other options that I may have? I really appreciate your show and thank you for your input. Sincerely, Tammy Brown, Antioch, California. Well, yes, Tammy, it's always the same thing, I'm afraid, when I get asked this question. My permanent advice is to sell the home, pay the bank off, and buy another home. Indeed, as you say, through another lender. Now, what I would say to you, given that you're not in any great hurry to sell the home, although I am in a hurry to see you sell it, make sure that you follow any broker's advice in bringing it up to scratch in terms of the most chance that you will have to sell the home. If that takes 2 or 3 months, so be it. But I think in your case, this is not a distress sale. I don't think you should rush into the market. I think you should put a price on the home, yes. But I also think that you should prepare it for sale as well as you can within a limited budget and then do it that way. That's the only real difference that I would place on what you have correctly identified as a non-win situation. So hopefully that will work for you. And do let me know how it goes. I will be all ears, as they say. Well, following on from my talk the other day about the single-mindedness of America's neocons to unleash war, one can only get the impression that America's propagandists and all those who follow in their wake are struggling with all their might to concoct rationales for military action of one sort or another, be it supplying weapons to the largely defunct Ukrainian military or staging parades of U.S. military hardware and troops in the almost completely Russian town of Narva in Estonia, a few hundred meters away from the Russian border, or putting U.S. so-called advisors in harm's way in parts of Iraq mostly controlled by Islamic militants. The strenuous efforts to whip up Cold War-like hysteria in the face of an otherwise preoccupied and essentially passive Russia seems out of all proportion to the actual military threat Russia poses. Yes, I'm sure volunteers and ammo do filter into Ukraine across the Russian border, but that's about it. Further south, the efforts to topple the government of Syria by aiding and arming Islamist radicals seem to be backfiring nicely. But that's the pattern, isn't it? What U.S. military involvement in recent memory hasn't resulted in a fiasco? Maybe there's a kind of surreal advantage in failure, which in those terms can be seen not just as an option, but more of a requirement. Let's have a look at some examples. Afghanistan has been the longest military campaign in U.S. history, and yet now it's being handed back to the Taliban. Iraq no longer exists as a sovereign nation. It's fractured into three pieces, one of them controlled by radical Islamists. Egypt has been democratically reformed into a military dictatorship. Libya is a defunct state in the middle of a civil war. The Ukraine will soon be in a similar state. It has been reduced to pauper status in record time, less than a year. A recent government overthrow has caused Yemen to stop being US-friendly. Closer to home, things are going so well in the US-dominated Central American countries of Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador that they've produced a flood of refugees all trying to get into the US in the hopes of finding any sort of sanctuary. How bad has all this really been for the United States? Looking at this broad landscape of failure, There are two ways to interpret it. One is that US officialdom is the most incompetent imaginable, utterly incapable of getting anything right. But another is that they do not succeed for a distinctly different reason. They do not succeed because results don't matter. You see, if failure were a problem, then there would be some sort of pressure coming from somewhere or other within the establishment, and that pressure to succeed might sporadically give rise to improved performance, leading to at least a few instances of success. But if, in fact, failure is no problem at all, and if instead there was some sort of eerie pressure to fail, then we'd be seeing exactly what we do see. Actually, there is the possibility that it's the limited scope of failure itself that is the problem. This would explain the recent saber-rattling in the direction of Russia, accusing it of imperial ambitions. Russia is not interested in territorial gains. Demonizing Vladimir Putin, who is effective and popular and behaving provocatively along Russia's various borders, leaving Russia vaguely insulted, but generally unconcerned. It can be argued that all the previous victims of US foreign policy, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, even the Ukraine, are too small to produce failure writ large enough to satisfy America's appetite for failure. Russia, on the other hand, especially when motivated by thinking that it's standing up to some sort of new American-style fascism, has the ability to deliver to the U.S. a foreign policy failure that will dwarf all the previous ones. Analysts have proposed a variety of explanations for America's hyperactive, oversized militarism. Here are the top three. One, the government in the U.S. has been captured by the military-industrial complex, which demands to be financed lavishly. Rationales are created artificially to achieve that result. But there does seem to be some sort of pressure to actually make weapons and field armies, because it would be far more cost-effective to achieve full-spectrum failure simply by stealing all the money and skip building the weapons systems altogether. So something else must be going on. Two, the U.S. military posture is designed to ensure America's full-spectrum dominance over the entire planet. But full-spectrum dominance sounds a little bit like success, whereas what we see is full-spectrum failure. Again, this story doesn't fit the facts. Three, the U.S. acts militarily to defend the status of the U.S. dollar as the global reserve currency. But the U.S. dollar is slowly but surely losing its attractiveness as a reserve currency, as witnessed by China and Russia acting as swiftly as they can to unload their U.S. dollar reserves. Numerous other nations have entered into arrangements with each other to stop using the U.S. dollar in international trade. The fact of the matter is, it doesn't take a huge military to flush one's national currency down the toilet. So once again, something else must be going on. There are many other explanations on offer as well, but none of them explain the fact that the goal of all this militarism seems to be to achieve failure. Perhaps a simpler explanation would suffice. How about this one? The U.S. has surrendered its sovereignty to a clique of financial oligarchs. Having nobody at all to answer to, this American, and to some extent international oligarchy, has been ruining the financial condition of the country, running up staggering levels of debt, destroying savings and retirements, debasing the currency, and so on. The inevitable end game is that the Federal Reserve, along with the central banks of other developed economies, will end up buying all the sovereign debt issuance with money they print for that purpose. And in the end, this inevitably leads to national bankruptcy. A very special set of circumstances and conditions has prevented these events from taking place thus far, but that doesn't mean that it's not going to happen, because that's what always happens sooner or later. When financial oligarchies seize control of a country, they can never control their appetites, and they inevitably run their countries into the ground. It always makes sense for them to have some sort of backup plan for if and when the financial house of cards falls apart. Ideally, such plans effectively put down any chance of revolt in the downtrodden masses and allow the oligarchies to maintain security and hold onto their wealth. Peacetime is fine for so long as it can placate the populace with bread and circuses, but when a financial calamity causes the economy to crater and bread and circuses turn scarce, the handy, tried and trusted fallback is always war. Always. Any rationale for war will do, be it terrorists, foreign and domestic, big bad Russia, or space aliens. Military success is unimportant, because failure is even better than success for maintaining order, because failure makes it possible to force through various emergency security measures. Various training runs, such as the military occupation of Boston following the bombings of the Boston Marathon, have already taken place. The surveillance infrastructure and the partially privatized prison industrial complex are already in place for locking up the undesirables. A really huge failure would provide the best rationale for putting the economy on a war footing, imposing martial law, suppressing dissent, outlawing extremist political activity, and so on. And that, frankly, is what we should expect. Financial collapse is already baked in, and it's only a matter of time before it happens and precipitates commercial collapse when global supply chains stop functioning. Political collapse will be resisted, and the way it will be resisted is by starting as many wars as possible to produce a vast backdrop of failure to serve as a rationale for all sorts of emergency measures, all of which will have just one aim, to suppress rebellion and to keep the oligarchy in power. Outside the US, it will look like Americans blowing things up. Countries, things, innocent bystanders, even themselves. Because, you know, apparently that works too. From the outside, looking into America's hall of one-way mirrors, it will look like a country gone mad. But then it already looks that way. And instead, the hall of one-way mirrors, inside the hall of one-way mirrors, it will look like valiant defenders of liberty battling implacable foes around the world. Most people will remain docile and just wave their little flags. But I would venture to guess that at some point, failure will translate into meta-failure. America will fail even at failing. I wish there was something we could do to help this meta-failure of failure happen sooner rather than later. Ladies and gentlemen, I know you think that this is all just me sounding off, but it really is going to happen. And if you have any sense of the future whatsoever, you really will be making plans to leave right now. I think I've said enough in past shows to convince those of you who will ever be convinced that this is the time to move. But I think now I have to wait for the financial implosion to show you just how devastating it will be. But by the time the implosion comes, exchange controls will already have been imposed, making it virtually impossible for you to get any money out of the United States. So there are ways of doing it, and I will tell you what to do, but for the time being, your real, real objective should be to get out. Well, who knew that the revolution would start with those radical Icelanders? It does, though. One Frosti Sigur Jonsson, a lawmaker from the ruling Progress Party, issued a report today that suggests that taking the power to create money away from commercial banks and handing it to the central bank and ultimately Parliament. Can't see commercial banks in the Western world to be too happy about this. They must be contemplating wiping the island nation off the map. If accepted in the Iceland Parliament, the plan would change the game in a very radical way. It would be successful, too, because there is no bigger scourge on the economies than commercial banks creating money and then securitizing and selling off the loans they just created the money or credit with. Under the so-called sovereign money proposal, the country's central bank would become the only creator of money. According to Mr. Sigur Jonsson in his proposal, and I quote, crucially, the power to create money is kept separate from the power to decide how that new money is used. As with the state budget, the Parliament will debate the government's proposal for allocation of new money. End of quote. Well, banks would continue to manage accounts and payments and would serve as intermediaries between savers and lenders. Pretty good idea to me. I think that should be instituted right now, but it never will be, not in the major countries of the West. The entrenched interests are too strong. Well, if two major newspapers in, say, Russia published major articles openly advocating the unprovoked bombing of a country, say Israel, the U.S. government and news media would be aflame with denunciations about aggression, criminality, madness, and behavior not fitting the 21st century. But when the newspapers are American, the New York Times and the Washington Post, and the target country is Iran, no one in the U.S. government and media bats an eye. These inflammatory articles, these incitements to murder and violation of international law, are considered just normal discussion in the land of exceptionalism. On Thursday last, the New York Times printed an op-ed that urged the bombing of Iran as an alternative to reaching the diplomatic agreement that would sharply curtail Iran's nuclear program and ensure that it was used only for peaceful purposes. The Post published a similar "We Must Bomb Iran" op-ed 2 weeks ago. The article in the Times by John Bolton, a neocon scholar from the American Enterprise Institute, was entitled, "To Stop Iran's Bomb, Bomb Iran." It followed the Post's op-ed by Joshua Muratchik, formerly at AEI, and now a fellow at the neocon-dominated School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins. Both articles called on the United States to mount a sustained bombing campaign against Iran to destroy its nuclear facilities and to promote regime change in Tehran. Ironically, these so-called scholars rationalized their calls for unprovoked aggression against Iran under the theory that Iran is an aggressive state, although Iran has not invaded another country for centuries. Bolton served as President George W. Bush's ambassador to the United Nations. He based his call for war on the possibility that if Iran did develop a nuclear bomb, which Iran denies seeking, and which the U.S. intelligence community agrees Iran is not building, such a hypothetical event could touch off an arms race in the Middle East. Curiously, Bolton acknowledged that Israel already has developed an undeclared nuclear weapons arsenal outside international controls, but he didn't call for bombing Israel. He wrote blithely that, ironically perhaps, Israel's nuclear weapons have not triggered an arms race. Other states in the region understood that Israel's nukes were intended as a deterrent, not as an offensive measure, even if they couldn't admit it publicly. Ah, what a mess. Well, within hours of Ben Bernanke launching his blog at the Brookings Institute, a few hundred economists to his blog had already been approved. Mike Shedlock made two comments of his own. He asked Bernanke about Fed-sponsored bubbles, inflation as measured by the CPI while ignoring assets, especially in housing, and whether or not the Fed had any culpability for what had happened. Mike was 99% sure in advance his questions and comments would be deleted. They were. Twice. Instead of posting serious comments and questions, the Brookings Institute fawned all over Bernanke by posting numerous glowing appraisals, thanks, and other trivia. The sole purpose of Bernanke's blog, which the Brookings Institute is shamefully willing to go along with, is to vindicate Ben Bernanke and the Fed from their role in the housing bubble. Others have chimed in on Bernanke's post and have had their comments and questions deleted as well. Well, about half the water usage in California's urban areas goes for landscaping, according to Jeffrey Mount, a senior fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California and a water expert. 2 weeks ago, California Governor Jerry Brown ordered a statewide water reduction of 25% for the first time ever, as California's drought worsens. Previously, he had sought voluntary cuts of 20%. The State Water Resources Control Board is expected to decide on new regulations over the next month. Brown's announcement said campuses, golf courses, cemeteries, and other large landscapes will have to make significant cuts in water use. But it didn't mention residential lawns. PPIC says outdoor residential use accounts for one-third of urban water use, twice that of commercial and institutional landscapes, including golf courses and cemeteries. Re-election, anyone? All right, well, our very own engineer, Donald Warren, has a question, or rather an email, that he has submitted to us as follows. Richard, if the U.S. simply had an 80% participation rate in its labor force, the economy would be flourishing. I presume the reality of this would show in a look at what impact of 80% participation would actually have for the country. If the country focus would steadily be on reaching this goal, the country would repair many of its problems. A happy society is a working society. Donald. Well, thank you for that, Donald. I think that's a profound comment and quite worthy of you, I should say. How about a British couple? Let's finish off with what happened to them. They won £1 million of the lottery twice. A British couple won the £1 million lottery in a national lottery for the second time, beating odds of 283 billion to one, according to reports on Wednesday. David and Kathleen Long continued buying lottery tickets after their first win in 2013 and struck lucky again last week. According to David Long, who made the immortal comment, "I just knew it would be my turn again." Oh, very nice. Well, he's a retired lorry or truck driver. Well, and, well, of course they say they can't believe it. I suppose if it happened, it happened. Anyway, good luck to them and good luck to everybody else, and have a really great week ahead, ladies and gentlemen. I will be back with you, as always, on Friday. So take care, be good, and until then, this is Richard Martin saying bye-bye.